Before we dive into today's discussion, we have a special resource just for you, a free ebook called Does It Make Sense to Believe in God? In today's world where faith is often labelled as outdated or irrational, this ebook takes a fresh look at the evidence for God. It features reflections from years of engaging with some of the world's leading atheists, like Richard Dawkins, and reveals why, after hearing every conceivable argument, our confidence in God's existence is stronger than ever. Download Does It Make Sense to Believe in God today for free at premierinsight.org/resources. That's premierinsight.org/resources. Now, let's get started with today's show.
The C.S. Lewis Podcast with Alistair McGrath.
Thank you for listening to the show that brings you the thought and theology of C.S. Lewis with me, Ruth Jackson. Discover more about Lewis by visiting premierunbelievable.com, where you can also find lots of great articles, resources and podcasts. And you can also register there for the chance to win a free book. If you enjoy listening to the C.S. Lewis podcast, please do consider rating and reviewing it. But now for today's show.
The 22nd of November marks 61 years since C.S. Lewis's death. In the lead up to that date, we are going to be hearing an episode from the Unbelievable podcast, which we recorded this time last year to commemorate the 60th anniversary of Lewis's death. What you are about to hear is the first part of a discussion I had with atheist Dan Barker and Christian Dr. Carolyn Weber. Hello and welcome to Unbelievable, the show that aims to get Christians and non-Christians thinking about topics that matter to all of us. I'm Ruth Jackson and today we are discussing C.S. Lewis. On November the 22nd, 1963, Clive Staples Lewis, or Jack as he was known to many of his friends, died in Oxford, England. His death was somewhat overshadowed by the assassination of US President John F. Kennedy on the same day. But today, we want to take some time to reflect on C.S. Lewis's life and ask the question, 60 years after his death, is C.S. Lewis still relevant? And I'm delighted to be joined today by Dan Barker and Carolyn Weber. Dan Barker is a former Christian, pastor turned atheist, who's co-president of the Freedom From Religion Foundation. Dan is an accomplished musician and author of numerous books, including God, the Most Unpleasant Character in All Fiction, that he's actually spoken about on Unbelievable. So do check out that episode because it's brilliant. Carolyn Weber is an award-winning author, professor and international speaker. Carolyn's first memoir, Surprised by Oxford, recently became a fabulous feature film. And both the book and the film tell her story of coming to faith from skepticism, a journey that in so many ways mirrors C.S. Lewis's own. And I had the great pleasure of having Carolyn on the show recently on the C.S. Lewis podcast to talk a little bit more about her story. Dan and Carolyn, thank you so much for joining me today.
Thank you for the invite.
Thank you very much, Ruth.
What I'd love to do for the first little bit of this is just to dive into your stories, because you've both got really interesting stories and in many ways they kind of go the opposite way. So Dan, if you're okay, I'd love to start with you. I mean, you spent many, many years as a Christian preacher, evangelist, musician, and you've written at length about your journey from Christianity to atheism in two of your books, Losing Faith in Faith and Godless. But would you be able to share just an abridged version of a little bit of your story for us today?
I was raised in a Christian family, a good, loving, great family. And we went to church since I remember, and I loved it. I was one of those kids who just thought I was so special to be in the right family, in the right religion, in the right denomination, in the right country, and in the right period of history. It just felt so good. And I used to preach and believe at the time that God has no grandchildren. You don't become a Christian just by being born into family. So in my teens, I did make a profession of faith. I confessed my sins and accepted Jesus as my Savior, according to what we thought the Bible said. And then not long after that, when I was 15, I was in a church service hearing a call, the Great Commission, to go to the whole world and preach the gospel. And you know, at that young age, as a young man wondering, what am I going to do with my future? It just all clicked. Yes, I'm going to be a preacher. And I started preaching right then. I felt, I experienced what I thought at the time, and it was very powerful. This almost goosebumpy feeling that I was, this presence was calling me, and that I was in the bosom of this love of this Father, all this whole thing, you know. Different Christians may frame it differently, but for me, it was just a very powerful experience. I started carrying my Bible to school. I started preaching to my high school teachers. I was that guy on campus, you know, with the Bible and with the love of Jesus. And I went on missionary trips. I played the piano for gospel groups and Southern gospel groups. And I did some record producing for some gospel singers, including Manuel Bonilla, who still is the leading Spanish-speaking Christian recording artist in the world. We did a whole bunch of albums back then in the 60s and then in the 70s and 80s. And I accepted what I was convinced was the call to the ministry. I got a degree in religion from Azusa Pacific University with what amounted to a minor in biblical Greek. I never claimed to be a great scholar, but it was a good training experience. I was ordained to the ministry in 1975, and I was an associate pastor of three different California churches, really believing in my theology. I know not all Christians feel the same, but in my theology, we thought Jesus was coming any minute. It could, like a thief in the night. It could be tonight. And so I really felt this love, this drive to win souls. I was a soul winner. I was out on the streets. I was preaching. I stood on park benches. We went into Mexico and we took over the whole park and were preaching to people. It was glorious. It was a great experience. Besides the ministry, also the intercultural experience of just traveling as a missionary. And I became a traveling evangelist after that third church sent me out as a sort of a U.S. missionary. For 8 years, I traveled from church to church preaching, hoping that Jesus would delay his return one more day so that I could win one more soul for the kingdom. And so I knew a lot about the Bible and theology, but I wasn't so deep into it. I was more like a soul winner. I wasn't like some expository pastor. And to make a very, very long story short, in my early 30s, after 19 years of preaching, really, because I started preaching when I was 15, I started reading other things besides what I'd been reading before. And, you know, before, as you say, I had read C.S. Lewis, some of his books, of course, back then, which made a powerful impact on me as a Christian at the time. But I went through a period of reevaluation, and part of that was due to the fact that the musicals that I had published as a Christian songwriter, one of them was a best-selling musical by Mana Music, and I worked also with Word Records. And then I also wrote some Bible school curriculums for a group called Gospel Light Publications, which was for like Vacation Bible School. I got invitations to preach and perform, not just by the extreme right-wing born-again fundamentalist churches that I was a part of. I was getting invited by a broader cross-section of Christianity than I was used to. So I came into contact with pastors from across this whole spectrum, learning there is no one Christianity. There's probably as many Christianities as there are Christians. There's all these different groups, and they're all splits off of something else, and they all are very confident about what they believe. And I met a whole bunch of those pastors, you know, more conservative, more moderate types, more liberal types, and many of them had performed my musicals, and they were more interested in that than in our theology. I remember one pastor told me that he had some members of his church who did not think Adam and Eve were real people. And I thought, what? And you let them be members? How can you do that? They, you know, either the Bible is truth or it isn't. It's either true or it's a lie. And if these people disbelieve God, how can they be Christians? That's how I was thinking back then, in that simplistic, absolutistic, black and white binary thinking that a lot of fundamentalists have. Not all Christians are like that. We know that. There are many more subtle, more broader types of Christians. But for me to move from here, you don't just start over here and then one day wake up and go, oh, silly me, there's no God. Ha, 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 ha. It took a process of 4 or 5 years of meeting people, talking with people, thinking, praying, reading the Bible, and gradually my theology migrated, not to atheism, but to a different type of Christianity, if you know what I mean. Most of my process happened within Christianity. It wasn't like anger at God or bitterness. I loved my Christian life. And as I moved a little bit more and more and more this way, I finally realized, you know, it's like drawing this line of what's essential and what isn't, you know, and different denominations have this big long list of what is essential belief. And of course, C.S. Lewis talked about what is mere Christianity. What is that mere Christianity? If you pull away the layers of the onion, what is at the middle there? I kept peeling, and I found out there is nothing in the middle. I learned at the end that what I was preaching is simply not true on historical grounds, on textual grounds, on scientific grounds, on moral grounds as well, what the Bible teaches. And I learned that there really is no coherent definition of a God. Everybody seems to think to know what that thing is, but there's no coherent definition. There's no agreement among believers about the nature of this God or his moral principles. There's no good evidence for this God. Yeah, there's evidence, but is it good evidence? There's no good argument for a God. And in the 140 debates I've done since that time, I still haven't heard a good argument for a God. There's a lot of arguments that might resonate with a believer, but if you're outside and you're hearing those arguments, they don't carry the same weight. So, and then there's no good reply to the problem of suffering, or what used to be called the problem of evil. And of course, books like the Bible and other religious texts turn out to be not very reliable, and in fact, sometimes internally contradictory. They become like a moral grab bag, and all these different denominations can pick which one they want, which is not to say that Christians are bad people. Most of them have good motives, and I think most Christians really are basically good, decent people, most of them, except for the extreme nutcases, you know. And then finally, I learned that there's no real need to believe in a God. I learned that there are millions in this country, tens of millions of good people who live happy, moral, productive, meaningful, joyful lives without believing in this being or supernatural world. And there's nothing to be gained from it unless you're afraid of hell, which is kind of silly when you think about it. What kind of a moral philosophy is based on a threat, you know, a threat of hell? And unless you're really, really afraid of heaven and hell, missing that. Or if your life is so dry that you need some kind of cosmic love to give your life meaning in some way. And most of the atheists I know don't feel that need. So there's no real need for that belief anyway, which is not really an argument against God, but it's a good argument for not needing to take it too seriously. So at the end of that period of time, and I'm making this long story really, really short, I realized, hey, what does that make me? I didn't even know what that made me until later. I thought, well, I guess if you're not a theist, you're an atheist. And so that's what I became at the time. And since then, I have to say, like many of my former, I know there's at least 1,200 members of the Clergy Project who used to be clergy who are now atheists and agnostics. That life is much, much better as a non-believer. And there's good reasons why.
Dan, there's a line in your book, Godless, where you say the motivation that drove me into the pulpit is the same one that drove me out. I was a minister because I wanted to know and speak the truth, and I'm an atheist for the same reason.
Yeah.
I mean, Carolyn, what do you think? Have you got anything you'd want to say to Dan's story? And I guess this kind of, it was seeking truth that drew Dan away. Obviously, we'll hear a little bit more about your story because it was kind of the opposite. It was your seeking truth that drew you to Christianity. But what are your kind of initial thoughts as you heard Dan speak just there?
I really appreciate you sharing that, Dan. It was really, really interesting and really articulate and really courageous, you know, to share that in a sense, because we so often, I think, feel that we're stepping into Christian presumptions and things as well. And also for you to evaluate where you were at from that time of being very young, too. I guess one of my first questions would be then, you said that, you know, folks then that feel that their lives are now better without faith or without God. I wondered if you could speak a little more to that. What would have replaced that? Or do you believe there needs to be a replacement? Or what would be the purpose then that would be substituted there or attractive in its place, or why they felt it was better?
Well, if you learn that it's not true, it's similar to having an illness. You're carrying something with you that's not true. And would you ask, what would you replace your illness with? I mean, you wouldn't ask that. You'd just be glad that it's gone, right? And then you can go on and live your life. But morally, of course, it's much superior to base moral judgments on actual harm, intention and harm in the real world, rather than on the orders or the dictates of something supernatural. It's very dangerous to base your life and your moral structure on some teachings of a so-called ancient holy book, because in a sense, you are not thinking for yourself. You are surrendering your thoughts. And there's a whole lot of Christian hymns that talk about that. I surrender, Lord. I am your servant. You are my master. This whole structure of it, Lord up here and we are down here. If you look at the postures of prayer, they are the same postures of slavery. The hands are shackled, the head is bowed, the knees are bent, and you're showing how little you are before this great Lord who's going to do all your thinking for you. That's dangerous. And most of us non-believers think life is much more navigable using the simple tools of reason and kindness and common sense. And in my case, a moral philosophy based on what I call the harm principle, which is kind of like utilitarianism, but not really. In any event, acting with the intention of minimizing harm, that's a clear principle. Whereas the moral principles of the Bible are not clear. You take any issue of the day, take any moral issue that we're struggling with right now. It could be birth control or abortion rights, or it could be the war, or it could be gun control. It could be the environment. I mean, there's 100 things you could name. You will find good, devout, beautiful Christian people on both sides of those issues. And they will use their Bible and their theology to justify it. You know that. There are Catholics for choice and there are Catholics against it. So the Bible itself and the teachings of Christianity turn out not to be a good specific moral guide. It's much more clear to use reason with the intention of minimizing real harm in the real world, which is something measurable. That's much better and much clearer. It doesn't mean you're always going to solve the problems right, but at least we have a good moral compass.
The C.S. Lewis Podcast with Alistair McGrath.
We're going to take a quick break now, but if you are enjoying today's show, please do consider rating it and leaving a review on your podcast platform so that other people can discover it too.
We're excited to announce the launch of a brand new podcast from Premier Insight called The Bible Explored with Rico Tice, featuring Rico Tice, a renowned British preacher and apologist. The Bible Explored with Rico Tice podcast offers practical guidance for living out the eternal truth of God's word in everyday life. It will inspire and equip you to boldly share the gospel, even in life's toughest situations. To continue creating content and resources like this, we rely on the generosity of listeners like you. Your support is vital to keep Premier Insight strong and ensure programs like the Bible Explored with Rico Tice podcast can reach more people and equip a generation of Christians to live out their faith with clarity, conviction, and confidence. Simply go to premierinsight.org/CS Lewis. That's premierinsight.org/CS Lewis. Thank you for your support.
The C.S. Lewis Podcast with Alistair McGrath.
Welcome back to the show. We would love to hear your thoughts and ideas. Do get in touch on social media at Premier Unbelievable. Now let's return to the conversation. Carolyn, we're going to talk a little bit about reason later, because Lewis clearly thought that they didn't need to be at odds, faith and reason. But I'd love to just delve a little bit into your story, because in many ways, your story is kind of the opposite of Dan's. And your story slightly echoes, I think, C.S. Lewis's own trajectory from atheism to theism while studying at Oxford University. Like Dan, you've sort of written about your journey in a book, In Surprise by Oxford. But again, would you mind just giving us a little brief summary of some of your story and I guess, you know, some of the reasons that sort of led you to Christianity? Because you were also, as we said, pursuing the truth in the way that Dan was.
I think we're both truth seekers in that sense, and very opposite story in this, in a way. I mean, I came from a very loving home too, but broken as well. I mean, I don't think those two are antithetical either, but when I was about 7 or 8, my father was a self-made man. I came from immigrant background, and he had lost his business and had been very affluent and ended up having a mental breakdown as a result. And my mother was raising us as a single mom. So my father was in and out of our lives. I was kind of from a mid-sized town in Canada, not particularly, you know, well off and middle class. But as my mom struggled to raise us, we were, of course, more poor in a sense. And eventually my father came in and out of our lives in volatile ways. My mom was very loving and very artistic and very intelligent, as was my dad in his own ways too. But she drank heavily in order to, I think, deal with the things that she was dealing with. And I probably would have drank more. So I was helping to raise my sibling and my participate financially supporting our family. There was a lot of financial duress. And to make a long story short on my end, I had sort of been exposed perhaps to a loose Catholicism, European Catholicism as a child from my grandparents. I was very close to my grandmother, but attended things in Mass in Latin, didn't really understand. My mom would have been probably loosely Catholic with some guidelines there, but really by the time I was entering into my teens, I didn't have any kind of religious framework at all. I'm a perfect example of somebody who went through the public school system without really cracking open a Bible, reading the Bible as I needed to. I won scholarships and things like that throughout the way to pursue literary studies, and had to read it as I needed to understand allusions and things. But I didn't really, I really believed in self-sufficiency and personal responsibility and pulling oneself up by their bootstraps and making my own way. And I certainly wasn't going to believe in the crux of religion or believe in an eternal father when your earthly one is not dependable. And yet I wouldn't have defined myself as atheist. I by my teens, I defined myself basically as agnostic because I couldn't disprove God either. So I wasn't quite sure which way. And I was probably, in a sense, a fence sitter, although to some degree, I had just really never been asked the question who Jesus was. For me, I would say also a great example, particularly of sort of our mainstream society, of somebody whose idea of Jesus was a big hair TV evangelist who took your money. I made fun of people exactly like yourself in your childhood. I thought things like end times and that were ridiculous, and spiritual warfare is not really pleasant in Canadian conversation. And there wasn't really any reason to land there. And what had happened is I knew C.S. Lewis as a child through the Narnia Chronicles. I hadn't really known him in any other way, shape, or form. But as I arrived at Oxford University on a Commonwealth scholarship for my graduate work, I was studying world religions for my MPhil at the time, and various theologies around the world as they were dovetailing into the 19th century and into British and European Romanticism. And I was really interested in progress of the soul theories. So I was reading widely in that sense, but I began to meet Christians, and I met Christians from all over the world at Oxford in ways that I didn't anticipate. I had people start to ask me these questions. I'd always been very busy surviving, working hard and multiple jobs and keeping my grades up and that sort of thing. And I'd never actually had been asked thoroughly and thoughtfully who God was to me. And I started to examine that. And as I did, I was drawn more and more towards Christianity. Partly Lewis was influential in that way, but actually first and foremost, it was the example of thoughtful Christians, people I met who were really living their faith meaningfully and kindly and thoughtfully. To me, reason and faith seemed antithetical and necessarily antithetical. And paradox to me had to be a contradiction, not an apparent one. And yet the more conversations I had, and of course these people were human too, but the more this was becoming incredibly inconvenient. And so I finally decided to read the Bible for myself, cover to cover, Genesis to Revelation. Because I knew lots of people who had a Darwin fish on the back of their car and had never cracked open the Bible for themselves. And that's not how I operated and how I did in my studies. And when I really, really read Genesis carefully, it again was also horrendously inconvenient because it really made sense. Sin made sense. Pride made sense. God is other, and the preference of other made sense. And that was really annoying. I was prepared for it to not make sense and to use the Bible as fodder for my argument against my Christian friends and for Christians in general, who as a category can be their own worst enemy. And so ended up, as I read it through, realized that Genesis really, really in fascinating ways rolled out to Revelation. And like Goethe says, I have not the imagination for reality. And I actually found it very compelling as a human story. And of course there are things that are weird. And of course there are things that are bizarre, but those are everywhere. It offered a coherent narrative. Christianity itself offered a coherent narrative. There are things about God that we can know. And there are things about God that are unknowable. I didn't find that to deny his existence. And I was also a feminist. I still am in many ways, in various shades and things as well. But Jesus was here historically. We have documentation of that. Something happened. But what fascinated me too was the power of story, that the Bible had something else going on underneath it. And it was, I ended up agreeing with someone like Bonhoeffer that the Bible is unlike any other text. And I'm not saying that I open it and, you know, I was very, very hesitant and very cynical or skeptical towards a holy Bible. But there was something else that was happening in the reading, and I really began to understand and seek to understand further how we are humanetical thinkers, how we are looking for various levels of truth beneath things, that either the surface is the surface and there's nothing else beneath it or above, or there is. And there might be multiple things happening at the same time, some of which we can see, some of which we cannot. And I couldn't deny, the more I read the Bible as a lover of reading, the more I realized what's going on in my own heart and in my own mind, but also that both made sense and also invited beyond that. And so I eventually became a Christian a few years later. So for me, I became a Christian as a result of what I read too. We have to be careful what we read.
I want to dive a little bit more into, you know, the title of your autobiography, Surprised by Oxford, and in some ways that kind of the synergy with this, with Surprised by Joy and sort of Lewis's search for joy, but also the fact that you were in many ways a reluctant convert in the way that Lewis was. And Dan, I'd also love to hear your response, but we are going to have to go to a little quick break here. I'm here with Dan Barker and Cameron Webber, and we would love to hear your thoughts as well about C.S. Lewis. Do drop us an email, unbelievable@premier.org.uk, or get in touch via social media at UnbelievableFE for X, formerly known as Twitter, or Premier Unbelievable on Facebook. That was the first part of a discussion that I had with atheist Dan Barker and Christian Dr. Carolyn Webber on Premier Unbelievable, looking at whether C.S. Lewis is still relevant today. You can hear the second part next week. Thank you for listening to the C.S. Lewis podcast with me, Ruth Jackson. Many of the topics that we've touched on today are discussed in greater detail on earlier episodes of the programme. Check out our archive of past shows at premierunbelievable.com, where you can also find lots of great articles, videos, and podcasts. Plus, if you register on our website or sign up for our newsletter there, then you will get exclusive access to new content, free resources, and more. That's premierunbelievable.com. What did you think of today's show? Are there any topics or works of C.S. Lewis that you would like us to explore next? We would love to hear from you. Send us an email, unbelievable@premier.org.uk. Connect with us on X, formerly known as Twitter, @premierunbelievablefe, or drop us a direct message on Instagram or Facebook @premierunbelievable. We have also recently launched on TikTok, so if that's your thing, or you know anyone else who might be interested, then you can find us there @premier.unbelievable. Your feedback and thoughts are so important to us, so please get in touch. If you're enjoying the C.S. Lewis podcast, please do consider rating and reviewing it on whatever platform you're listening on, as it helps more people to discover the show. Thank you for listening, and see you next time.
Attention everyone! Wayfair's Black Friday preview sale is here early. Right now, get up to 70% off everything you need for the season ahead. Save on furniture and bedding, cookware and holiday decor, and tons more. Now's the time to score big on finds to feast, get festive, and get comfortable all season long. Plus, enjoy fast and easy shipping with delivery in time for the holidays. Save up to 70% off early Black Friday deals. Shop now at Wayfair.com.
Wayfair. Every style, every home.